Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 184 and we're picking up our story on Old Year's Eve, 1850. Last episode, you heard how Cape Governor Harry Smith had holed up in Fort Cox, and the Amakhosa were now in control of most of British Kaffraria, the Eighth Frontier War in full flow. There were fears amongst the settlers that the war would spread as far as the Cape Colony, and 5,000 British troops stationed in southern Africa were now spread as far as across the Orange River. What was unclear was what was going on across the Kai River. Had the Kaleka and Paramount Chief Sandile decided to join in with Makoma and Imlanjeni? It was unclear about the situation in the villages and towns, and what about the Amakonukwebe? Were they going to remain neutral? Missionary George Brown was still searching for his wife, Janet, and the infant. He didn't know yet that she was on her way to Fort White and was safe. When we left off last episode, Brown had been accosted close to his mission station at Ikabira, where Chief Makoma, who led the rebellion, demanded he answer questions. We'd also met Makoma's main translator, who historians believe was Hermanus Matrus, although he never formally introduced himself to George Brown. The reason why we spent some time talking about Matrus is because he had convinced many in the Cut River settlement to join the uprising against the British. One raid too many by the Redcoats into the Cut River followed years of being badmouthed by the English settlers, led by the odious editor of the Grahamstown Journal, Robert Godlinton. This had all pushed the Khoi Khoi over the edge. Mlanjeni the prophet had preached that an uprising against the British would succeed, and so far he appeared to be correct. It was Saturday, 28th December, 1850, late afternoon. Brown and his guide, a man by the name of Dutani, were allowed to continue on their way by Makoma after a grilling and a few hours of being lambasted. Then they arrived at Ikribira Mission Station. They trekked a mammoth 55 kilometers that day. Somehow they had made it through crowds of warriors across unforgiving landscapes, but the missionary found his wife and child gone. His belongings were being looted by Xhosa warriors who refused to tell him what had happened to the station. It was too dangerous to hang around these men, some of whom had dressed themselves in both Janet's gowns and dresses and his trousers. The extraordinary scene of warriors daubed in ochre, red, wearing Victorian hats and petticoats, was not one which Brown found faintly amusing. It was distressing. They made their way to Stockwell's Kraal nearby. One of the warriors came over wearing Janet Brown's cashmere shawl. It was Tsaba, who had known Janet since she was born, but he shrugged off questions about her fate. The missionaries had failed to fully understand the ways of the people they had supposedly come to convert. They still expected to be treated as men of the cloth while representing an entirely different culture, and because they were of their time, they could not conceive of the Amakhosa treating them simply as white men who had been part of a wave of people taking away their land. I've read Brown's self-penned biography. It's online. I'll share a link to that book on my blog. As you know by now, Brown was a man who'd broken quite a few rules already. He'd got Janet pregnant and then forced to marry her. He'd been promiscuous and used some of the Amakhosa women he had converted as his concubines. It's important, these facts, because at this point, as he arrived at Stokwe's Kraal near his mission station, Tsaba referred to him as Impi, soldier. He wanted to be known as Mfundisi, the teacher, but now he was merely being identified as an invader. Luckily for Brown, who'd survived a number of attempts by various warriors to assegai him, relief came in the form of Unuqina, one of Stockwell's wives. She fed him mass, buttermilk. He recovered, and then he received word that Janet had carried the infant son all the way to Fort White and both were alive. Brown burst into tears. That night he lay down on the floor next to Unuqina and her children, a wood fire burning on the polished dung floor, sharing a blanket with Totani. Every now and again warriors popped in. Someone would stir the fire. Outside, a pack of dogs howled, perhaps wild dogs. He could hear sounds of hyenas that could still be found along these slopes. At dawn, he and Totani made their way out of Ikabira and Stockwell's area towards the Tumi Valley. Such are the stories of war, and such are the moments within these wars. Sunday, 29th December, and on that very day, Colonel Henry Somerset, commanding officer of the Frontier Forces and commanding officer of the Cape Mounted Rifles, was on his horse heading towards Fort Cox. He was trying to save Governor Sir Harry Smith, who was besieged there, although his dispatch riders had failed to pierce the Amakhosa warrior perimeter the previous night. Somerset was in his 60s. Quite a sight he was. Large handlebar moustache, dapper in dress, but regularly almost useless in his actions. This was the man upon which the entire British response dangled. Somerset's father was Lord Charles, who had returned home after his stint as governor of the Cape between 1814 and 1826, and who died in 1837 at the age of 63. His son Henry, back in South Africa, was almost that age and still leading soldiers in the field as a lieutenant colonel. Henry was popular with his men, who called him Baron Jack, mainly because he was regarded as a bit of a scoundrel with the women, particularly the Khoi Khoi women. He always travelled with a large entourage of Khoi servants and concubines, and that was the whisper back in Grahamstown and Cape Town. But people back in Grahamstown and Cape Town were always whispering about what the Somersets and others like them were up to. It was gossip. However, the gossiping may have hidden one of the little-known facts, that some of the Cape Mounted Rifles Khoi troops were actually Henry's sons. But none of the malice intended at besmirching his name seemed to rub off on Baron Jack, and his own troops, particularly the Cape Mounted Rifles, regarded him as their true leader, whatever the gossipers said. His men loved them, partly because he loved sending them to the beach with a band, rather than into the bracken with a rifle. He had turned into the beau ideal of a cavalry officer of the old regime. One trooper wrote that he was like a fine-looking old man, a regular Vosges d'Afrique, old man of Africa, and that his bronzed complexion and fine features well contrasted with his large moustache, which, with his hair, was snowy white. Just to finish off the picture, he always rode a white horse, a white charger. All of this is true, but what Somerset faced now was existential in its threat. The Amakhosa didn't care what size his moustache was or what colour his horse. As the Vosges d'Afrique rode towards Fort Cox, he faced insurmountable odds. He led a force of only 150 British foot soldiers from the 91st Regiment out of Fort Hare, along with 70 men of the Cape Mounted Rifles. They dragged a 3-pound gun along with them. This piece of artillery had proven itself across the world, in India, in Africa, in the Americas. It was a 25-kilometre ride from Fort Hare to Fort Cox, and Somerset's first plan was to reach a strategic ridge almost halfway. From there, he'd send dispatch riders to sprint to Harry Smith. As the force trundled out of Fort Hare, they were set upon almost immediately by the Khoza. Company commander Lieutenant A.J. Melvin was wounded, and the gun was brought to bear. But the Amakhosa were not dismayed by the single piece of artillery and continued their attack. Henry Somerset's nerves snapped, and he ordered a retreat back to Fort Hare. This is where things began to go really badly wrong. The gun carriage broke, and instead of leaving it, Somerset ordered his men to try and push it along. The Khoza set upon this group of soldiers, shooting and stabbing at will. They swarmed in their hundreds, and had been trained well by Makoma, using all defensive positions with great skill. Each time the British seemed to fight back, Amakhosa reinforcements appeared. Tactically, the redcoats were receiving a lesson in hand-to-hand combat. The Amakhosa general was paying Somerset back for his repeated raids into the Amatolas, burning down Khoza homes, shooting men, and sometimes women and children too. This battle is almost lost to history. Afterwards, none of the main historians of the time mentioned it. Colonists like Teal and Corey, South African historians, ignored it. This was an event without a name, a four-hour-long retreat along a wagon road at the end of 1850. At least 20 British soldiers were killed, many more wounded, and things could have been a lot worse had 100 soldiers inside Fort Hare not rushed out to their assistance. Military historians compared the courage of the fighting here between the British soldier and their African counterparts to the fighting that would rage around Rorke's Drift 18 years later. Not one of the British or Khoi soldiers would get a medal for the retreat to Fort Hare in 1850, Unlike Rorke's Drift, where 11 Victoria Crosses were dished out, the most in any battle in history. Yes, unlike Rorke's Drift, the retreat to Fort Hare was expunged from colonial memory because it was a defeat. But it was not a dishonourable moment. The rank-and-file soldier fought with great courage. Even Macomber paid the British soldiers a compliment later, saying the men of the 91st Regiment had died fighting and cursing to the last. But it was too embarrassing for the English to admit they'd been given what we in South Africa call a snort clap by the Amakhosa. The Khosa chief at the same time had led his men with aplomb and had the tactical advantage of initiative and movement. Half of the British troops on the eastern frontier were sealed up in Fort Hare and Fort Cox, along with Smith and his two most senior commanders, while the Amakhosa had the freedom of movement. They could go wherever they liked, whenever they liked. The British were stuck at King Williamstown and inside all posts around the Amatola Mountains. People of Grahamstown were hunkered down behind their defences, at least those who had not fled to Port Elizabeth. The shock of these last few days seeped into the consciousness of all settlers and soldiers. And to make things worse, the defeat of the 91st was not the only bad news on Sunday 29th of December 1850. Somerset was to hear that Hermanus Matruis had convinced his fellow Khoi Khoi and coloured brethren in the Cut River settlement to join the Amakhosa uprising. He turned his attention swiftly to the Khoi Khoi men of the Cape Mounted Rifles, where some had already joined the Khosa. Meanwhile, across the Kaiskamma, Missionary Brown's feet were blistered. He had no horse. He was walking to the Tumi to be with his wife, the grass crunching under his boots, the temperature over 32 degrees centigrade. At one point, he and Tutani reached a high point, and they watched the defeat of the 91st Regiment down in the valley. Both missionary and guide were in a state of collapse. They still had 40 kilometres to go, much of it across broken country. By mid-afternoon, they arrived at the kraal at the top of the Kaiskamma Ridge belonging to Makoma's mother, Nomvakalisa Notonto, of the Nkosi people. She had been one of Chief Nika's 30 wives, a descendant of the Khoi Sotho clan within the confederation of people that made up the Nkosi. Her home reminded Brown of any old person's home, cluttered with memories of the past. Calabashes, skins, wall hangings, worn-out pots, treasured over time, had kept as mementos. Nomvakalisa Notonto ordered meat for her guests. Her son may have been shooting and chopping up the settlers and the British, but she was a stickler when it came to good manners. After feeding them, Nomvakalisa bade the two adieu, and on they went, passing groups of women and children who'd ransacked mission stations and the villages, the spoils of war in their hands, the two hobbling towards Tumi. They passed warriors carrying the detritus of battle, dead British soldiers' uniforms, guns. Then they came across the British and Khoza bodies lying where they'd fallen and saw that Khoza were taking away their dead while stripping the British bodies. Finally, the two staggered into Tumi, exhausted, shattered, but alive. Hermanus Matruis, meanwhile, commanded an echelon, more like a battalion-sized group of 900 Amakhosa troops. He'd switched sides numerous times over the past 20 years, and this was to be his last switch. The colonial government had granted him land at the Cut River settlement, choice land for his various services. They liked him so much. Matruis's farm was in a strategic position, which had a great view of the Cut River area, a mountain-cupped bowl through which the Cut River flowed in a series of broken ground, little outcrops, small valleys, intersected by streams and ravines. Matruis's farm was only 14 kilometres from Fort Beaufort. His home was at the junction of four main wagon roads that circled the Amatolas and linked the territory to Grahamstown. The British knew how important this was and had built Fort Armstrong in the middle of the Cut River area, alongside the town of Phillipton. And next door to this was a mountainous area, which the Dutch had named Waterkloof. And Waterkloof was Macomber's favourite redoubt, his favourite hideout. Matruis had thought long and hard about his position, and he knew he needed to cut off and destroy Fort Beaufort and Fort Armstrong. And to do this, he needed the men of the Cape Mounted Rifles to rebel and join him. They were his Trojan horses inside Carthage, so to speak. After seizing Fort Beaufort, he could threaten Grahamstown and Fort Hare would be cut off completely. Then his Amakhosa allies could launch a direct assault on Fort Hare or lay siege or both. As you heard in earlier podcasts, the British had not built top-of-the-range defences at any of these forts. None had artillery to speak of. Their redoubts were earthen. They had logistic issues and poor water supply. Fort Armstrong was already cut off. Matros and his Cut River rebels had ensured there was no way of reaching this fort or leaving it. So Matros shifted his gaze to Fort Beaufort, where a paltry company of 50 men were hunkered down, along with a Cape Mounted Rifle cavalryman. But these cavalrymen did not join the mutiny. It was touch and go, but they didn't trust Matros. He was a chameleon who switched allegiances like a weather vane, spinning with every shift in the wind. Henry Somerset sat at his desk in Fort Hare on the morning of the 30th of December and wrote a message to Cape Colonial Secretary John Montagu. "Send levies," he cried. Levies was code of the time for coy or coloured conscripts. Somerset knew that Matros had switched sides. He wanted Montagu to stop the rebellion spreading to coloured people living in the Cape, and if the levies were mobilised, there'd be less chance of them joining the uprising. Panic stakes. Fort Armstrong was in real danger now, a weak point, and Vieux Zafrique, Somerset, had to do something, or the fort would be overrun. He commanded 400 men inside Fort Hare, but this was more than 60 kilometres from Fort Beaufort, and then another 22 kilometres to Fort Armstrong. Considering how he'd been utterly defeated a day before, Somerset was not exactly motivated to mobilise his men, but he had no choice. It was at this moment that it occurred to the governor, Harry Smith, the hero of various battles in India and South Africa, that he could not leave Somerset in charge of matters. The man was basically useless. And so, on New Year's Eve, Harry Smith disguised himself as a coloured cavalryman and escaped from Fort Cox with 250 men of the Cape Mounted Rifles. Smith's initial plan was to ride as far as Fort Hare and then relieve the skittish Somerset, but decided after reaching Fort White that he'd actually stop at King Williamstown instead and base himself there. That was wise. The Amakhosa had figured out he had just escaped from Fort Cox and were hunting him down. He wouldn't have made it all the way to Fort Hare. It says something about the people of this time, whatever your political persuasion, that they were prepared to do the utmost in moments. Smith and the 250 Cape Mounted Rifles had fought all the way along the trail to King Williamstown. Yet the people of King did not welcome Smith, remembering his bravado, his hype, the boorish behaviour, and the citizens now aimed pointed criticism at the man they blamed for the war. His order for Mackinnon to march through Bomber Pass had triggered the rest of the calamity facing the British. Native Commissioner Charles Lennox Stretch said that the march was the maddest project that ever entered Sir Harry Smith's brain. Smith went on the offensive now, slapping up a government notice in King Williamstown like some kind of frothing sheriff of the Wild West, demanding that the residents help to destroy and exterminate these most barbarous and treacherous savages. By doing so, he was admitting his enemy was formidable. All main forts, Cox, White, Hare, Armstrong, were cut off like little oases of redcoats in a sea of ochre-coloured Xhosa. There was a little glimmer of light. Amamtlambe Chief Amhala was still neutral, but as you'll hear in a moment, not all Ntlambe people were sitting this one out. This meant the road between King Williamstown and East London was still open. Batu of the Qunuqwebe also remained neutral, at least for now. This was a crucial strategic opening for the British. Had this route been shut, each of the forts could have been strangled in the sieges, destroyed, exterminated. Instead, reinforcements could arrive on this frontier in a matter of days instead of months. Port Elizabeth to East London by ship was 3 days. The other route via Grahamstown was shut by Xhosa ambush by one of the few Amamtlambe chiefs who joined the war. Siyolo hated the English, and he seized a strategic river crossing at Lion Drift with a small group of men from the Cape Mounted Rifles who had mutinied. Also hunkered down at Fort Murray in Qunuqwebe territory was John McLean. He was the commissioner responsible for the Qunuqwebe and the Amamtlambe, as well as the other Amakhosa who remained neutral, stretching down to the coast of the Buffalo River, down to East London. And McLean was not prone to panic. He was shrewd, Unlike many around him, he did not routinely underestimate the Xhosa people. On New Year's Day, Maclean galloped like the clappers from Fort Murray to join Harry Smith in King Williamstown. If he was shocked by what Smith now told him, he didn't let on, at least at that time. Because Governor Harry Smith, who had issued an edict in 1850 declaring that henceforth the Amaxhosa would be ruled by the Queen and not by their chiefs, announced in a confidential meeting with Maclean that he was going to rescind his edict. As we know, it was Smith's declaration he was going to destroy the chiefs that was one of the major causes of the Eighth Frontier War. The deluded governor appeared to have had an epiphany, and he told Maclean he wanted to spread the word amongst the Amaxhosa that their chiefs would go back to governing their people according to their own laws and customs. Maclean warned Smith that if he did a complete 180 on his views, it would imply a collapse of all authority, a major weakness. So they agreed that only Patu of the Kunukwebi would be informed about this change of policy. As soon as Maclean galloped back to Fort Murray, Smith met with Amamhlambe chief Toise and told him of the new British policy. Hearing that the cat was out of the bag, Maclean begrudgingly told him Hala, main chief of the Amamhlambe, what Smith had decided. Needless to say, everyone who was informed of this astounding admission of failure by the British were astonished. Furthermore, by admitting that his policies had been dangerous and worthless, Smith destroyed his own career. Colonial Secretary Earl Grey had originally advised Smith against his policy of destroying chiefly power, saying it would lead to chaos. So, dear listener, one of the most important effects of the Eighth Frontier War in South Africa was to convince the British that their concept of Pax Britannica in Africa was the right way. Smith's terrible mistake cemented how British colonialism would function in Africa until they withdrew in the 1950s and 60s. This is not well known, but Grey's plans for governing West African states and others became more certain because of Smith's disaster. And with that, we end episode 184. Please rate the podcast on your favorite channel, or you can head off to the website desmondlatham.blog and sign up for my newsletter and send me messages. Until next, au revoir.